Hello, everyone. I'm Erin Schaefer. I'm a grad assistant at the Women's Center, and I'd like to welcome you to Women on Wednesday. A few items before we get started. Please turn off pagers or cell phones, and please remain in your seat until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. Also, if you could fill out an evaluation sheet, we use this for future programming. Our session today is titled Remember AIDS, Women Affected in Minnesota. In spite of the fact that women comprise 19% of all AIDS cases, many women see AIDS as irrelevant to them personally. This could be a deadly mistake. The Centers for Disease Control reports that women's risk of AIDS is climbing and will top men's worldwide if new HIV infections continue at their current rate. Today's talk will discuss the unique issues that women face because AIDS intersects with racism, sexism, and other forms of discrimination. Our speaker will address the factors in addition to the facts of preventing AIDS. I'd like to introduce Luanda, who is from OPA, who is co-sponsoring this event.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Luanda Majo, and I'm the current president of the Organization for Prevention of AIDS here on campus. Our organization works on, we have two missions. It's to educate people because I'm sure, like you will find out from Lauren's presentation, prevention is the best thing in education, to educate people. Once people are educated, they're able to prevent themselves from getting this disease. We also fundraise money. Over the past 8 years, we have fundraised over $72,000, which we have sent over to countries in Africa. So we're a very well fundraising organization. I'm also working on my senior thesis is also on HIV in Africa and HIV here in the United States. Last summer I lived in DC, which is one of the cities where the AIDS rate is increasing. And I'm from South Africa, where they say, you know, one in every four people is affected with AIDS. So AIDS, it's everywhere, especially here in Minnesota. I hope Lorraine will go more into detail with that, because a lot of people are not aware. They think this is a disease that's happening in Africa, or this is a disease. Some are still thinking it's a disease within the gays, but the reality of it all is we're all either affected or infected with the disease. And I'm grateful that you all were able to come, and you will get educated for sure. The previous speaker mentioned, Lorraine today is our speaker. Lorraine has been the executive director of MAP, the Minnesota AIDS Project, since 1990. Her leadership has led to the development of peer support programs, a community building program, and an advocacy program for individuals living with AIDS. Lorraine has worked with nonprofits that work with marginalized populations, and in 1998 was awarded the Brian Cole Leadership Award from the Human Rights Campaign. And once again, this event is co-sponsored with the Women's Center and OPA. So we are very grateful to have her here with us. Please join me in welcoming Lorraine Teal.
Thanks very much, and what a great turnout. So let me just start by saying, if you have questions about what personal risk you might have or the specifics of how this virus is transmitted, I'm not going to go into depth in all of that, but I want to encourage each and every one of you to go online to the Minnesota AIDS Project website, which just Google Minnesota AIDS Project or mnaidsproject.org. We have live on-chat anonymous capability for you to ask every question that you ever wanted to ask from one of our AIDS line educators, or you can send them an email if you're doing that during off hours. But specifically today, I want to talk a little bit about women and HIV, not only here in Minnesota, but do a little comparison to how HIV in Minnesota differs from how HIV is in other parts of the world. And remember, AIDS is really apropos. Just last year, when I did a presentation at the Minnesota legislature, a very well-educated, well-meaning, well-intended legislator said, "Oh my, what a surprise to see you. I thought we had taken care of AIDS here in Minnesota. I knew it was still a problem in Africa, but I didn't think it was so much a problem here in Minnesota." And you may have recently seen in the news that in 2009, there was a 13% increase in new infections here in this state, the largest number of new infections since 1992. So clearly AIDS is still a problem here in Minnesota. So let's start with a little bit about did you know. that HIV is the leading cause of death for women across this world between the ages of 15 and 44. And I suspect that almost everybody, except me, perhaps, is in that age group. So it is still a serious issue. And what year do you think that report was released? Any guesses? That's right, 2009. So still an enormous issue worldwide. So we need to see where we came from to understand how we got to the point where we're at, where close to 30 years after HIV was first named AIDS in 1981. This was one of the first symbols that came to be recognized with HIV. It was developed in the 1980s, Silence Equals Death, and it was a symbol of an advocacy group called ACT UP, or the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. It utilized the pink triangle, the symbol taken by the Nazis to identify gay and bisexual folks during World War II that ultimately went into a number of the death camps, and as a means to reclaim that symbol. Early on, we tried to educate people that AIDS was not easily transmissible, that you could hug someone, you could touch someone, you could be near someone with AIDS, because there was just total panic here in the United States and, frankly, across the world. The symbol that none of you young people would remember was Rock Hudson, who in 1985 was a very, very well-known actor, kind of the George Clooney of the day, if you will. And quite a leading man, heterosexual lover of sorts, who led a very secret life as a gay man. And he contracted AIDS. And it really stopped the clock in this country to think that someone like a George Clooney would actually have contracted this virus. And he died fairly soon after the revelation that he was living with AIDS. The next big person that brought attention to this disease was in 1991 when Magic Johnson, a basketball player with the LA Lakers, announced that he had AIDS. And like many famous sports figures, Magic had talked a lot about how many sexual encounters he had had with women. And yet everyone in 1991, and I was working at MAP then, was speculating, that's impossible. Men cannot contract this virus from a woman through sex. He must be gay. And in fact, he did contract the virus heterosexually. Women early on, this was a poster actually early of materials trying to target women, because it wasn't that women came late into this virus. From the very first days of HIV, women were contracting this virus. And here we have this anonymous woman, and for decades now, women have been anonymous in the epidemic of HIV, most especially here in the United States. So the early days of AIDS, as I said, there was widespread fear, widespread panic. Schools that had students who had contracted this virus, most often young males who were hemophiliacs, schools refused to accept them. Raise your hand if you know who Ryan White was. Very few people. Ryan White was a young teen in Kokomo, Indiana, who was not allowed to attend school because he had contracted this virus. And the school district basically was more willing to shut down the school than allow Ryan to attend. His house was shot at. His mother's car was destroyed. Ryan eventually had to move, and he finally died, succumbed to this virus in 1989. And in honor of the work that he did, he was a very vocal young man for being so young. The number one federal source of funding to provide support for people living with HIV these days is called the Ryan White Care Act. But early on, this virus infected very dispersed groups. And the challenge for scientists was to try to find what was the common link. Because what was the common link between gay men, hemophiliacs, people that in early days didn't realize it was that they were blood recipients, injecting drug users. There was really this widespread panic, and the link between HIV and heterosexual sex really only came later. There was a lot of speculation early on about why did gay men contract this virus at such a high rate. Some people thought it was because of just merely the fact that they were gay men, and there was something about male-to-male sex that was different. Some people felt it was because of the use of various drugs that gay men might have used to enhance the sexual experience that brought on AIDS. There were so many questions, and it really took a lot of investigation. And honestly, if we could go back in time, we wouldn't have these two words, HIV and AIDS. The word AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome being a word that just is really a medical term meaning a collection of symptoms, AIDS was discovered, the symptoms, the disease was discovered before the cause of that disease was discovered. So in 1981, there was a recognition by the Centers for Disease Control that there was this thing happening affecting largely gay men and then some injecting drug users, some people from Haiti, some weird groups like newborn infants or grandparents. And they all had this similar thing. Their immune system was compromised. So the disease was named AIDS in 1981, and it wasn't until about 1985 that the virus itself, HIV, human immunodeficiency virus, was discovered. So if we could go back in time, it would have been better if we would have just named this thing HIV disease. Early stage, chronic, late stage, end stage. But we're stuck with these two words. So someone has to be HIV infected before they go on to develop AIDS. But AIDS turned early on into a political disease. And I like to say it's because AIDS is the flashlight that shines on the three things Americans don't like to talk about: sex, drugs, and not rock and roll. But sex, drugs, and death. And those are three things that we all talk about, but we all talk about privately. We don't want to talk about publicly. We don't want to talk about in schools, in ways that really will educate young people. And so we've come up with shorthand ways to deal with sex, drugs, and death. When it comes to sex, the message that we most often give to young people is, just wait till you get married. Which we know is not something that is widely practiced. It is certainly something that is great for people who choose that, but for those who don't, we need to teach people how to protect themselves. When it comes to drugs, we have a really easy response to drugs, and that's just say no. And when it comes to death, sort of the way that as Americans we deal with death is we really hope that people that get old or people that are really sick and are dying aren't around us, that they're in a nursing home or a hospital where professionals can deal with them. And certainly in the early days of AIDS, when so many young people, frankly your age, were dying of this disease, it was traumatic to this country to all of a sudden have so many folks in their teens, 20s, and 30s dying of this mysterious disease. And there was early on this division into two groups of those who brought the virus on themselves and those who were the innocent victims. And the innocent victims were most likely hemophiliacs, those who contracted the virus through a blood transfusion, those who had sex with someone that they didn't know was either perhaps a woman having sex with someone who they didn't know their partner was, had a number of other partners, male or female, or that their partner was injecting drugs. And so those were the innocent victims. And gay men were grouped into the sort of the guilty party. And there was a lot of backlash. And in hindsight, it was not a good argument, because gay men argued, look, we didn't know what this thing was. We didn't know where it came from any more than anyone else. We didn't go out looking for it. And so back in the early 80s and even into the early 90s, there was this move to say everyone's innocent because nobody knows where this virus came from. The backlash is fast forward 2010. There's now a belief that those of you who will go on to contract HIV are dumb. Frankly, how could you not know about AIDS? How could you even think about having sex without a condom? And we know for a fact that condom use is not very widespread. It needs to be taught, that people don't intuitively know how to practice safer sex. People don't intuitively know what risk factors are. And in this day and age, there's often even arguments over what sex is. Is oral sex sex? Is kissing sex? And so lots of questions to be answered. So we still deal with that today. So as I said, people that were living with HIV faced stigma, shame, and discrimination, and still do. Again, fast forward to 2010, we still in our legal program have people who lose their jobs, lose their housing, face discrimination because of their HIV status. And there's an interesting day coming up in Cleveland. I'm friends with my peer, he's the executive director of the AIDS Task Force of Cleveland. And on March 26th, which would be, I believe, this Friday, in Cleveland, some 800 folks have signed up to wear a shirt that day that says HIV positive. And they're going to be out and about at their jobs, schools, workplaces, etc., wearing that shirt to begin to raise awareness, to elicit a conversation once again about HIV. And I know that they're all going to be Facebooking and tweeting, whatever, in terms of what kinds of reactions they're getting from people. And so I think it'll be an interesting social experiment, because today people still face that stigma and discrimination. And so we know the driving forces of HIV begin with silence. And as that earlier graphic showed you, silence does equal death. If you don't ask the questions, if you don't understand how this virus is and is not transmitted, it leads to ignorance, and ignorance often leads to fear and prejudice, stigma, discrimination, and it becomes this sort of vicious cycle that unfortunately is where we're at today. It was interesting to hear that you're doing your paper on comparing how AIDS is handled in other parts of the world, specifically Africa, versus the United States. Under President Bush, started something called PEPFAR, or the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And it was a huge source of funding, primarily targeted to a number of sub-Saharan countries, some countries in the Caribbean, to help get medications out to folks who were still not able to get these medications. And one of the requirements for that funding was any country that received funding had to have a national AIDS strategy. They had to have a plan in place. The U.S. government insisted that they have a comprehensive plan. So what country doesn't have a comprehensive plan to address AIDS? That's right. The United States has no national AIDS strategy. And it wasn't until this president was elected, President Obama, that we began working in 2009 on developing a strategy for a disease that has now killed hundreds of thousands of Americans. And there are over a million Americans living with this disease. So to not have a plan to have addressed this is, in my mind, absolutely criminal. And the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Health Department, is now, in 2010, just beginning some work on developing a statewide strategy for addressing AIDS. There have been plans in place in order to qualify for funding, but at my age, those are kind of games that bureaucrats play to get the money, but to have a really good, solid, comprehensive plan. So, in fact, I want to just use this slide to show you a little bit about the politics of AIDS. That yellow line on the top are new AIDS diagnoses, and you can see that spike where they went up quite dramatically in the early 90s. And in 1993 was when they reached the pinnacle. And that was because the diagnosis of AIDS was ironically one of the only diseases that was tied to an entitlement program, meaning that if you were disabled because of this HIV virus, you had to have a diagnosis of AIDS in order to get Social Security and in order to get health care, Medicare. And so you had to get that diagnosis. Well, in order to get the diagnosis, pre-1993, there were a number of criteria that a physician had to use to say, you are HIV infected, we've confirmed that in a blood test, and you also have one of these conditions. And because you have one of these conditions, I'm going to say that you have AIDS, and now you'll be able to get access to health care. Well, the list of conditions that qualified you for this assistance were defined primarily by men who had been living with AIDS. And women who were living with AIDS got very different conditions. So I cannot tell you how many thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of United States women died of HIV infection because they didn't meet this diagnosis. Simply put, as a great example, men who get HIV infection sometimes go on to develop yeast infection, and it manifests in their mouth as something called thrush. Women who get HIV get a yeast infection, but it doesn't manifest as thrush. It manifests as vaginal yeast infection, and that turns into pelvic inflammatory disease, and that turns into cervical cancer. And so women who were HIV positive who had this yeast infection, because it wasn't in their mouth, didn't qualify, didn't meet the definition. And as advocates, we fought to expand that definition to bring women into this count. And that's why we had this big spike. And it drove the epidemiologists, if there are any epidemiology students, I apologize, it drove them nuts because they're kind of numbers counters. And they don't like to see spikes that they can't explain. So 1996 in the world of AIDS was a very landmark year. Prior to 1996, we had what we called monotherapy, where there were a few experimental drugs that people with HIV could go on. And in 1996, this whole new class of drugs was introduced. It wasn't a cure. It still isn't a cure. But unfortunately, it was perceived as a cure. And some of the language that we used around this so-called drugs really continue to be a problem. We refer to the treatment for HIV most often as the drug cocktail. This is the United States. I mean, who doesn't like drugs and who doesn't like cocktails? I mean, it's a horrible name. And so I remember a 60 Minutes piece right after 1996 where they actually interviewed some young men about the drug cocktail, and they actually did think it was a real alcohol drink. It came in a little martini glass. And it isn't. It's a toxic dose of medications that stops the replication of this virus in your body. And it also, by the way, does a lot of other things. It impacts your kidneys, your liver, your brain, your heart, all kinds of other situations. And we're just now coming into 15 years post the beginning of these drugs, and we're beginning to see some really challenges for people who have been on these medications for years. So not only is it not a cure, it's not that simple, oh, you could take a pill for that kind of problem. And we also began to talk about that the problem wasn't here, the problem was there. And there most often was sub-Saharan Africa. And as you'll see in a later slide, sub-Saharan Africa has borne the brunt of this disease and continues to bear the brunt of this disease. But you know what? We can do two things. We can recognize it's a problem there, and it's a problem here. Other language that we used, and for any of you who might be students that really enjoy studying the use of language, you really need. We all need to be careful how we use language. The media most often has talked about how the face of AIDS has changed. And when we use a phrase like the face of AIDS has changed, to me that means it was this, it's not that anymore, now it's this. And we played games, the media played games, politicians played games with statistics. The fastest growing rate of HIV is in this population. Well, if you go from 2 cases to 4 cases, sure, that's a big rate increase, isn't it? But if you go from 2,500 cases to 3,800 cases, it's a lot more people. But the rate isn't the same. And from the very early days of AIDS, women, people of color, gay, bisexual men have been at risk for this virus for lots of reasons that we'll talk about. So here's a little picture of kind of the so-called drug cocktail. And this isn't something that is cheap or very easily tolerated. And so for those that think HIV maybe isn't a death sentence, if nothing, it will forever alter your life. And I talked about how sub-Saharan Africa has borne the brunt of this disease. And this map to scale shows where the deaths due to AIDS have been over the past some 25 years. And if you look at it, obviously you can see India and Africa as being the countries that have borne the brunt of deaths due to AIDS. And relatively speaking, how small the United States and Europe are. And that speaks to access to healthcare, access to medications. And there are lots of other reasons why this epidemic took hold in sub-Saharan Africa, where the numbers simply were so great. So a little bit about where we are today. Right now, as I said, it's estimated that over 1 million Americans, probably about 1.2 million, are living with HIV. And 25%, and that's an estimate, don't know. And why is that important? Because if you don't know, you can't take measures to prevent the transmission to others. And in a really cruel, ironic twist of nature, for those individuals newly infected with HIV, the amount of virus in their body will probably be the highest it ever will be until just before their death. Because this virus is new, you know, when you get a cold or a flu for the first time, you've never had that kind before, you really get sick. And it's because your immune system doesn't recognize this strange invader. So when HIV enters your system and sticks, which is really important, you can be exposed to this virus and not seroconvert. It's not automatic, but we can talk about that in a little bit. If this virus enters and infects your system, the amount of virus flowing through your body will be, as I said, the highest it will most likely be in your lifetime. And particularly, well, not particularly, but for men newly infected, that triggers an increase in testosterone. And without giggling, we all know what men who have lots of testosterone flowing around their system want to do, and that's have more sex. And so that's why men in the early infectious stages who have more than one girlfriend, more than one boyfriend, or maybe a girlfriend and a boyfriend, are so likely to transmit this virus and not even know that they themselves are infected. We know in America there are about 56,000 Americans infected each and every year. That works out to one American every 8 minutes infected with this virus. And as I said earlier, last year we saw an increase of 13% right here in Minnesota. That increase was still primarily male, primarily gay bisexual men, primarily gay bi men of color. For young people, over the last 3 years, the number of young men infected with HIV were all gay and bisexual young men. Over the past decade, and when I say young, that's 15 to 24. But over the past decade, women in Minnesota have increased from 10% to now over 25% of new cases. And as you can see, predominantly women of color. So a little bit about the numbers. 34 million people in the world with AIDS. As I said, over 1 million are Americans. Worldwide, close to 3 million new infections every year. Again, 56,000 here in the United States. And still, 2 million people die of AIDS every year. And since 1981, 25 million. These numbers are so enormous, they're almost impossible to get your hands around, and that's why I like that map earlier that really shows. Here in Minnesota, there are currently over 6,000 Minnesotans known to be living with HIV. You can see the breakdown, 75% male, 25% female. Of the men, three-quarters gay bi men, disproportionately African-American and Hispanic. And of the women, 75% women of color. So why are women at risk? It's a matter of biology. Simply, this virus is in, when women have heterosexual sex, this virus is present in concentrated amounts in semen. It's not in the sperm, it's in semen. It's just simply a matter of biology that there's more surface area of the inside of a vagina than there is on a penis. So a woman is more likely to be infected. It's a matter of comorbidity factors. We know women face all of these issues around the world, as well as here in the United States. And a really poignant example of economic power is that when you have so many women who are widowed in poor countries and have children, often women will have to turn to any means they can to support their children, and sometimes that includes sex work. And women always put their children and others first. So even for those women who are negative, the burden of this disease is enormous in terms of caring for orphans, sick relatives, and the economic hardships that come about. So this slide shows you a little bit about how this plays out in Africa versus here in Minnesota. As you can see, 50% of all the AIDS cases in sub-Saharan Africa are women. 50% of all AIDS cases across the world. 68% of all AIDS cases live in Africa. And when we look at the population of Africa, it's largely women. And 98% of women living with AIDS in this world live in Africa. And there are 12 million orphans. You can see a little bit of the data here. Of the 368 new reports last year, 20% were in women. 4% related to IDU, which is injecting drug use. So predominantly, this is a sexually transmitted disease. This is not something, I don't have to worry because I don't shoot dope, she doesn't shoot dope, he doesn't shoot dope. This is a sexually transmitted disease everywhere in the United States. We know that transmission in Minnesota, mother to child, is a huge success story. Since 2000, the year 2000, there have been 468 babies born here in Minnesota to moms who are HIV positive, and only 1% of those infants were born with HIV. Prior to the advent of these new drugs that can prevent that transmission mother to child, you can see that there were 22% of the infants born were HIV positive. So we can stop the transmission mother to child at the time of birth. So what drives the epidemic? Poverty is a cause, and whatever makes people vulnerable as a result of poverty, including violations of people's rights, access to health care, discrimination, all of those are factors that drive HIV here in Minnesota and across the world. So there are other factors driving new infections. We talked a little bit before about the lack of comprehensive sexual health education, which does start with and include abstinence. But without going further and talking to young people how to prevent this virus, we have a problem. And I like to say that with young people, when we have little tiny children, we teach them not to play with matches. But we also tell them, you know what, if a fire starts, you call the 911. Because we know they might play with matches. So just like we can teach young people to dial 911, we can teach age-appropriately young people how to protect themselves by using a condom when they first have sex. Homophobia continues to drive this epidemic. It leads gay bi men to lead closeted lives, to take high risk, to not recognize the risk. Access to prophylactics. Prophylactic, just a big word for condoms. And that's a real issue. You know, pretty much anywhere in this state, condoms are available 24/7 at a Super America or at a drugstore, all-night drugstore. But if, you know, you're having sex in the back of a car at somebody's apartment or at your parents' house and you don't have a condom with you, they may be available, but they're not accessible. So we really need to emphasize access. Most importantly, however, for women is the lack of a female-controlled barrier. We could spend hours talking about why men don't want to use condoms. Ultimately, what will stop this epidemic is something that we hope will be developed soon, a microbicide, a cream or a gel that a woman could use vaginally that would kill HIV. And so far, there aren't any candidates. There are a number of possibilities being researched, but nothing on the market. So again, what drives this? Poverty. For women, it's poverty, economic inequality, educational inequality, and the burden of disease that women already bear. And if we don't figure this out, this chart shows the number of women between 2001 and 2003. You can see the increase in some countries is the darker line. And if we don't fill this out, this is the United States, where this lovely pink arrow will float to in a minute. You can see that women increased between those years. If we don't figure this out, we're just going to continue to see those numbers go up. So for right now, right here in Minnesota, we know that the number of women living with and at risk for HIV continues to grow. You know, if you think of HIV infection and death from AIDS as water going into a sink, and the water coming into the sink are new infections, and people dying are those literally going down the drain. People aren't dying, and that sink is really full of potentially individuals who can potentially transmit this virus. And again, 25% of whom don't know. So do you want to know your status? Do you want to understand what puts you at risk? And how do parents and, yes, even grandparents educate young people about this risk? And how do we get comprehensive sexual health education as a mandate? You know, this healthcare reform that we've all been hearing about for months and months that passed, great stuff for some people, think it's great stuff. Some people don't, but whatever. I won't get into the healthcare debate. But what I will get into is the fact that we know abstinence-only education has been a failed strategy. And under President Obama, the funding for that ended. With the healthcare reform, the funding started again. That was part of the trade-off. So we're back to abstinence-only education. So HIV, AIDS, STDs, STIs, sexually transmitted diseases, sexually transmitted infections, that's an alphabet every one of you need to understand. This is a sexually transmitted disease. It's preventable. If you are infected already with an STI, like chlamydia or herpes, you increase your risk of contracting HIV if you're exposed to this virus. You talked a little bit earlier about the high rate of HIV in Washington, D.C., and in some places in sub-Saharan Africa where it's estimated that one in four is infected. We know in five cities right here in the United States, amongst gay bi men of color, 46% of African-American men were already infected, one in two. So these are African-American gay bi men. So it's an odds game, and I don't think any of us want to play odds. Your parents don't want you to play odds with your lives. And if we don't get the facts, what will happen is these numbers will continue to grow. These are the numbers of folks worldwide that have contracted and are living. But I think what's really important is that each of these numbers is a story. And actually, this is a photo from South Africa, the Treatment Action Group from South Africa. Each one of these folks tells a unique story of their experience of living with HIV. And this is a woman's issue. And as women, I think, and as men who care about women, it's really important that we remember that HIV has not gone away. It's time, as this poster out of Uganda suggests, to put the red ribbon back on. Very few people know that the Red Ribbon actually, the whole ribbon thing, started with AIDS. And we think, in fact, a woman that works at MAP, her daughter in high school, argued with her because she said that breast cancer started the ribbon. And we now have ribbons for every color, which is terrific. I'm not anti-ribbon. But I think to understand the impact that this virus has on people, it's important to remember HIV. So we're going to open it up to questions. And so any questions? Are fair questions, and I'll repeat them so that we all hear them. So, who's got the first question? Yes.
What's a place like a women's center on a college campus be doing to help increase awareness and, again, remind people that AIDS is still an issue?
Yeah, great question. The question was, what should a women's center like here on the college campus do to raise awareness and remind people? When I started this, if I can get back to the F5, that little logo in the corner, March 10th every year is National Women and Girls AIDS Awareness Day. So doing something in March would be a beginning. December 1st is World AIDS Day. Certainly doing something around that time. Having condoms available and in talking to people and having videos available that people can look at that show how to correctly use a condom. Have someone around that can even explain what a female condom is. A lot of people don't even know that there is something called a female condom. So having speakers like me, peer educators are great. Training people to be peer educators, I think, is critical. So you had a question down here?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Did you have a question? I can send it to Aaron, and then. So, if anybody, the question is, if anybody wants a copy of the PowerPoint, I will email it to Aaron at the Women's Center, or.
Yes, and you know what? This is going to be podcast.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
5 days Women's Center website.
Okay, so 5 days Women's Center website. It'll be up there, the PowerPoint.
And it might be sooner.
Okay. I'll send you a copy when I get back today. So, okay. All right. Right. The question is basically, are there tips or techniques how to begin the discussion? And I think, you know, it differs from family to whether or not it's a potential sexual partner. I think certainly with any potential sexual partner, the first conversation has to be safer sex. There can't be this, oh, they look okay. They don't look like they have AIDS. They don't look like they're gay. They don't look like whatever. You have to assume, just like when you go to the dentist or the doctor and they put the latex gloves on, they and the mask in some cases, they're assuming that there's something that they don't want to get. And that's what all of us need to assume until we are sure that our sexual partners don't have a sexually transmitted disease or HIV. And so I think just the open, honest, hey, I'm not going there. You know, no glove, no love. And there's a lot of sort of, you know, ways to bring that up before it gets to that critical moment.
And what
I yes.
What
yep.
Could I ask people the same thing? If we're going to end in 4 minutes, and it's really disruptive for people to leave, but we will meet right at 12:50. We will end the session. So thank you.
Thank you.
And as far as legal issues, like,
That's a great question, and we Yeah, we get that question a lot. The question was, are there any legal implications for someone who has HIV and transmits it to someone else? There have been a few criminal cases brought against people. The challenge is it often turns into a he said, she said, or a he said, he said. Hey, I told them I had it, and they said they didn't want to use a condom. They weren't worried about it. That's not true. They never told me, yes, I did, no, you didn't, yes, I did, no, you didn't. And so it's really very difficult in a criminal case to prove that burden of proof. Does someone with HIV have a moral obligation? Absolutely. Does someone without HIV have a moral obligation to their partner to say, you know, I don't know, maybe I have HIV, maybe I have chlamydia, maybe I have gonorrhea or syphilis. I'm going to use a condom. And just because you went in and had an STD test a year ago, it's not a vaccine. So I hope that answered. Any other questions? Yeah, over here. Mm-hmm. It went down because I think that there was this huge onslaught of testing and women that came into the system, yes. But what we're seeing now is it went down and it's starting to go up. So if you look at the graph in Minnesota, we're starting to see kind of a bell curve again going up. So any other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what do you know of anything right now, any update on what is being done in the study of trying to find something to
The question was, is there anything out there that can control the disease or eradicate the disease from someone's body? And the answer is no. I mean, there's really only been one or two handful of cases documented where someone was diagnosed as positive and then later undiagnosed. And most likely it was a misdiagnosis in the first place. There was a belief early on, for example, that some people have heard of a heart-lung machine, where when you have heart surgery, they take your blood out and kind of send it through a device while you're having surgery. And the thought was, because HIV is so fragile to heat, it dies when exposed to heat. What if you just heated that blood up just enough to kill HIV? And then put it back in clean blood. Well, they did that, but what they didn't understand was that the virus is in the brain and it's in the lymph system. And so that clean blood came in and then was immediately reinfected. One of the challenges with these medications regarding HIV being in the brain is that the medications cannot pass what's called the blood-brain barrier. So you may have a low virus in your system, but the virus in your brain could be quite intense, and we're beginning to see lots of cognitive problems with people who are long-term survivors of HIV. So I think we have one more quick question, if there is any. Otherwise, do I get to say you're excused? Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I'll stick around for a few minutes, so if there's anyone that has an offline question that maybe you don't want to ask, let me know.